I'm going to turn our attention to other birds now and the Birders Conservation Handbook, 100 North American Birds at Risk. Until now, there's been no single comprehensive source on the status of North America's most threatened birds and what you and I can do to help protect them. And this handbook is the only book of its kind written specifically to help birders and researchers understand the threats while hopefully providing actions to protect birds and their habitats. We'll talk about it now with the author, Jeffrey Wells. Jeff is doctoral, PhD, senior scientist, Boreal Songbird Initiative, and author of this book, Birders Conservation Handbook. It's published by Princeton University Press, and we're really pleased to have him with us by phone today. And certainly, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Jeffrey Wells with us by phone. Jeffrey, hi. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry.
What was really pleased to have you along. What was your impetus in writing this book?
Well, the impetus was really a paradox that many of us working in bird conservation had been noticing, and that is that we are seeing various surveys that are showing that the interest in birds and wildlife watching and things like that and bird feeding is growing almost exponentially. The newest estimates out are that there's something like 80 million people in the United States who are interested in birds or bird feeding, bird watching, or take their kids to wildlife refuges to see, you know, wildlife spectacles and things like that. And yet, at the same time, we're seeing the numbers of reports about bird declines increasing. So we see this sort of upward trend in people interested in birds and yet a downward trend in birds. We're seeing reports like Audubon's recent report about common birds in decline, of many birds that people think of as common backyard birds that have declined by 50, 60, 70, 80% over the last 30 years, and increases in extinction rates, the extinction rate doubling in the last 100 years or so. And, you know, so there's this sort of paradox. And that was kind of the impetus to write it. And my feeling about why, one of the reasons we're seeing this paradox is that people in the increasingly complex economies we live in and production lines and so on, we're not really understanding how our day-to-day decisions are impacting the birds that we love. And we also often aren't aware of the simple ways and the really positive conservation opportunities there are to actually stop the declines of birds.
Yeah, and I especially like that part of your book. You have some good, solid suggestions for people, and we can talk about those suggestions. And I want to get to our phones, Bob and Viola and some others as well here as we move along. But first, I just to ask, how did you come on the 100 birds that you selected? There could have been probably 300 birds, I suppose, that you might have selected.
Yeah, it was a tough decision. And actually, as I did research for the book, I found that there were over 500 bird species in the United States that are listed by one or another conservation organization as of concern, some government, some non-government. And so, you know, that's actually over 50% of the birds that regularly occur in North America. So I had to whittle it down to a manageable number. And what I tried to do was to take the set of species that everybody would agree on, the most endangered birds, and then there's another set that more arguable as far as which ones you would include out of those 500. And I tried to find species that were representative of different ecosystems and representative of some of the different kinds of threats and conservation opportunities there were out there.
Yeah, I like that a lot. For each species, you've got ecology and threats, and as you say, action and conservation needs for each species, and its course is different.
Yeah, and I think one of the ideas I had behind this was that there's a lot of really surprising and interesting connections and facts that if people had them at their fingertips, it would really help in making decisions about how to start growing more birds or slowing the declines, at least.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Bob and Viola. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry, thank you very much for having this show. A question to your guest. The whippoorwills have disappeared here. I used to be able to sit on the porch and call them in, just imitating them, years past. Ground nesting bird, I'm afraid maybe the cats have taken them. I've had as many as four cats at our place, not ours, at one point in time. And I don't know, what are your feelings? Where have the whippoorwills gone?
Yeah, whippoorwills have really experienced major declines across a large part of their range, and there's probably a set of factors interacting, including increasing fragmentation and urbanization of habitat and the resulting increase in things like cats, as well as predators like raccoons and skunks and things like that that take the eggs. And there may be some other issues related to, pesticides and sort of an overall effect on the food supply, because whippoorwills, of course, are insect-eating birds. And so that's one of the birds that we still don't know as much as we need to, and there's actually been some increasing work in monitoring whippoorwills and some of the other night birds. I've heard that story over and over. Where I'm from in Maine, we have all kinds of streets named, Whippoorwill Lane and things like that, and there are no whippoorwills there anymore. And I haven't heard a whippoorwill in Maine in years. And, I grew up around, my grandmother telling the story of the whippoorwill outside the house that used to drive her crazy because it would call all night. And there hasn't been a whippoorwill near where she grew up and lived for probably, 20 years. So, it's a part of our culture. You think of the great songs about whippoorwills that are out there. And, to imagine losing that part of our cultural heritage is really a sad
thing. Yeah. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, by the way, if you'd like, at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. We're talking with Jeffrey Wells today. Jeff is author of Birders Conservation Handbook. It's published by Princeton University Press, and I'm told that the copies are flying off the shelves. Jeff?
Well, hopefully, bird books are all flying off the shelf, just part of our fun, punny stuff. But we're hoping to really get a lot out there. The hope is that the more people that will pick up this book and hear about the issues in opportunities like this will become interested, and we'll start moving those 80 million people from being interested in loving birds to doing something in their lives, even small changes that will start helping the birds they love, and they'll see the connection. So, yeah, we're hoping that this is going to have a big impact, and there's lots of ways that people can get involved, fortunately, including things like the film festival. Often people don't think of the fact that these issues are all interconnected, and the work that folks like Bill McKibben and Lloyd Spencer Davis are doing are intimately connected to allowing us to really help birds.
Oh, absolutely. And again, I'll give that number, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, you can reach us at 263-1890. And Linda's online from Eden, so let's go to Linda. Hi, Linda. Thank you for calling. Linda, are you there? Oh, wait a second here. Let me get her on. Now, Linda.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question is, we have a nature trail behind us. It used to be an old railroad bed, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful area. Our town board, and now our county board, approved the use of ATVs and snowmobiles on it. And my question is, could your speaker address the foolishness of this, or what will happen to the birds who nest there in the winter, or the changes that will happen because of the motorized vehicles now?
You probably can't say specifically for that particular spot, Jeff, but I'm sure you might probably have some general comments.
Yeah, the whole issue of increased recreational use of areas as we sort of increase our footprint on the land is a major one, and of course ATV and snowmobile use is getting more controversial in lots of places like that. It depends on a lot of interacting factors as to how much of an impact that is. Oftentimes, the biggest impact is on the aesthetics of the people who love to go out and hear the birds and enjoy them. But there are increasingly large numbers of studies that show that birds in the summer are impacted by the noise from different kinds of activities like roads or industrial complexes and things like that, and that you see because, of course, they sing to each other to sort of establish territories and communicate, then the more noise there is, the more likely it is that it'll be harder for them to do that. So there's been some studies that have shown a depression in the number of birds, the densities of birds along roadways, for example, or near oil complexes and things like that. And so there could well be, depending on the level of use of a particular area, something like that. On the other hand, if it's a very small area, it may not have a major significant bird population. So it's kind of a trade-off. I hope the main thing that issues like that bring to my mind is the need for protecting very large landscapes, large areas where you can kind of accommodate lots of different uses and allow for enough space so birds can be protected.
Yeah. Jeff Wells, our guest today, Jeffrey Wells, author of Birders Conservation Handbook. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy you're along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller with you. And as well with us is Jeffrey Wells. Jeffrey is author of Birders Conservation Handbook, 100 North American Birds at Risk. He is the Boreal Songbird Initiative senior scientist, author of the book. He's also a nationally acclaimed bird expert, conservation biologist, widely published in both academic and popular settings. Really pleased to have him with us today. And certainly, if you have questions, you're most welcome to join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And Jeffrey, worth going again, I think going back to the book and just explaining how you've got your book organized.
Sure, Larry. Yeah, the book is set up so you can actually just flip into it to a species of interest. And for that species, it shows a range map that it shows the entire breeding and wintering range. And for some of those birds, that encompasses everything from the Arctic all the way to southern South America. And I'm sort of proud of that because a lot of bird field guides cut off the range maps at the U.S.-Mexico border, so you don't know anything about where they go. And we really need to have a holistic view of these things in order to take care of them. Then there's a part that tells about the status of the birds and a part about the threats, but then a part about the good news conservation actions and activities that are helping the birds or that could help the birds. Sort of give ideas and models for ways people can either support or get involved or maybe even start their own project to help some of the birds.
And as well, during the news break, I went to your website, the Boreal Songbird Initiative website. It's a beautiful website.
Thanks. Yeah, we have worked hard to try to make that an outlet for getting information out and make it attractive and interesting and a great way for people to learn more about birds.
And I think probably if somebody types in Boreal Songbird Initiative, that's probably the easiest way to get to it.
Yeah, I think even Boreal Birds would. It's just borealbirds.org.
It's really easy. borealbirds.org.
Yeah, that's the easy way to get to it. And, yeah, we have a whole online bird guide and lots of screen savers and fun things to download and just lots of information, reports, and media that talk about bird issues. And I have a blog that I maintain there talking about sort of my own personal views and interconnections with birds and birding and bird conservation, and we have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, you must. Tony in Jackson County has a question for you, so let's go there. Tony, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. You mentioned the diminishing population of the whippoorwill. Did you indicate any reason why?
Well, we think it's probably a combination of loss of habitat from just increased development and sprawl in many areas, and also increasing numbers of things like cats and other invasive species that are sort of the numbers of those, both cats as well as things like raccoons and skunks and things like that are sort of increased when we fragment habitat and have more urban areas. And then there may be some factors related to increased use of pesticides and impacts that on large insects. They really eat a lot of large moths, apparently, and so there may be some things we've done with pesticides that have decreased populations of those, but it's still something that we're trying to understand more. But, you know, in many areas you can see that the habitat is just no longer suitable because of increased urbanization and suburban, housing developments and all the cats and the animals that come along with that and that sort of thing.
Thanks, Tony. Maureen in Oshkosh, it's your turn. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. I always wondered why birds, like the little hummingbirds, fly north. And, why don't they just stay where it's nice and warm and instead of making that big trip and then having to go all the way back again?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an excellent question and one that has consumed the careers of many ornithologists over the years.
Yes.
But the basic story behind that is that when birds, in the tropics, there are just a lot of different species in really high competition for resources. And so birds that migrate are able to go up and get into habitats that have often like a flush of insects or, in the case of hummingbirds, flowers and things like that, really very large food sources for that brief summer period and much less competition. So, the thought is that it's much easier to raise young there, and oftentimes they do raise a lot more birds that are in these temperate and northern regions will raise a lot more young in a breeding attempt than tropical birds that may just raise a couple of young in a season because there's such intense competition for food resources as well as sometimes a lot of predators in that habitat as well.
Yeah. That's a good question, Maureen. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. If you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. We've got some open lines. We'll get you on pretty fast here. Let's talk about Wisconsin birds for a few minutes. And I know you probably can pick out four or five bird species that are doing the worst in Wisconsin. What is one of the birds that's not doing so well in Wisconsin?
Well, just let me preface that with one note that whenever you look at a region like a state or a smaller region, you do have to be a little bit careful in how you consider how species are doing because you can often have a case where a bird that's just very common at the national or global level happens to be doing poorly in a particular state or region, and it's always a tricky thing because you don't want to expend a lot of resources necessarily on something that is very common globally but happens to be declining in your area. So just that's one thing to consider in some of the birds that I would mention. But there's actually about 22 species in my book that regularly occur in Wisconsin. And some of the ones that I would highlight as among those of greatest concern, one of them would be the greater prairie chicken,
yeah,
a grassland bird. And probably many people have heard of the issues related to that bird and its plight. But there were something like 55,000 prairie chickens in Wisconsin in 1930, and now about 1,500 or so.
Yeah, under 2,000.
Under 2,000, yeah, and supported mainly by some really intensive work to try to maintain the habitats and the birds in certain in a couple of key areas. There's also another related grassland bird, the Henslow sparrow, which has declined by more than 80% over the last 30 or 40 years in North America, and also needs these sort of large grassland, large native grasslands. You want me to tell you a couple of the others? Or?
Well, let's stop there for a minute because we have a lot of people online to visit with you, and Barbara in Richland County is up next, so let's go to Barb. Barbara, hi.
Hello.
Thanks can for you, calling.
Yes, can you talk about the connection between boreal birds and toilet paper?
Absolutely, yes. It's one of those funny conservation secrets that I sort of talk about in my book and in our as we're doing our conservation tour. But there's two little known facts I think for many people in the U.S. that there's about somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 billion birds that pour over the U.S.-Canadian border every fall out of the boreal forest of Canada into the U.S. About 1 billion of those winter in the U.S. and another 2 billion go on to winter south of the U.S. So there's this what we call the Great Bird Nursery in the boreal forest where we get a huge number of our birds, including some of the most common ones that are in everybody's backyard even right now, like white-throated sparrows and dark-eyed juncos, just for an example. So we have this great source of birds that are sort of exported from this boreal forest, and yet, and a lot of people don't know that, and yet there's this other connection, which is that most of the factors that influence the future of those birds in that boreal forest are related to consumerism in the U.S., and one of those connections happens to be that a huge proportion of the boreal forest of Canada is cut to make toilet tissue and paper towels for U.S. consumers. It's kind of amazing when you think of this is like virgin forest, never before cut, and it's cut for that that purpose, and also for junk mail and mailing catalogs. Huge amount of it is cut to make cheap fiber for sources like that. So here we have another odd paradox. Mm-hmm. The birds we love in our backyard, we don't really think about where they're coming from, but we could be watching out the window, you know, seeing the white-throated sparrow at the feeder and ripping off a paper towel in the kitchen to clean up a spill and, you know, almost, you know, killing, you know, the birds we love without even knowing it.
It's an interesting story. Barbara, thank you for that call. Don and Warren, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hi. I've got a dear friend who is a retired professor at Michigan State, and we had spoke about the decline in bees and what it might be, and he said it was interesting. They had a couple of grad students up there that noticed that there was a marked decline in the pheasants. So they did a field study, and they spent a lot of time at it. And they found that the chicks were hatching all right, but when the hen would call the warning call for them to disperse and go hide in the grass, they didn't heed it. And then when she'd call for them to come in and feed, they weren't tuned into it. Like their brain had been rewired, and as a result, they had very very high predation. Predator birds and foxes and stuff that were just cleaning them out because their brains weren't wired properly anymore. This was rather interesting, and this might be spilling over into other things we're not paying attention to.
Yeah, we're starting to really understand that there's a lot of unknown and unexpected effects from things like pesticides and other chemicals that we're releasing into the environment, and you know the amount of some of these is amazing. There's something like 200 to 300 million tons of hazardous waste, including pesticides and other chemicals, released globally into the environment, and you know tens of thousands of synthetic chemicals. And we're just starting to learn the effects, especially in sometimes limited windows in reproduction. Of course, this is true in humans as well as birds, and really a real cause for concern, something that people are just starting to wake up to. But Yeah, it's interesting that stories like that are starting to prop up more and more.
Thanks, Don. Annette, in Stevens Point, we turn to you next. Hi, Annette.
Hello. I have three questions I'd like to ask.
Okay.
The first is about the decline of the red-headed woodpeckers and the evening grosbeaks. We feed birds, and we live in a wooded area, but we're at the edge of the woods. And we've seen these birds before, but not for some time now. And so I'm wondering what has happened to them and what we can do about it. And then the other question would be if he has any suggestions as to what we can do about this junk mail, the mountains of it that we get.
Mm-hmm.
How can we prevent that even from happening?
Well, that's another good question. And I think, just as an aside, I think one of the things that we've seen with the do not call lists, so people can't be calling at home any, calling your home any longer. Here in Wisconsin, we have a pretty strong law on that. But that has in turn resulted in an increase in mail, solicitations through the mail. So that's actually increased while the calls have decreased.
Yeah, that's a real good observation and a good question. Just to start off with that latter question first, there are some efforts going on right now to see if we could change the way many of the junk mail and mailing catalog producers use fiber, in particular, to try to get them to increase the amount of recycled content and to use, if they do use fiber directly from trees, that they use it from sustainably managed forests. And there's been some great efforts that have had some great results in getting people who are interested in birds across the U.S. and Canada to apply pressure by writing letters and things like that and emails to some of the companies that are the largest producers of mail order and tissues and things like that. And we've seen some great success. The company is called The Limited, that produces Victoria's Secret catalogs and mails something like a million a day. They actually just this past spring, after a whole series of events to really put pressure on them, agreed to start increasing the amount of recycled content and things like that. There are some programs out there where you can give your name and the catalogs, the company's names, and they will send letters to try to get you off the mailing list. And of course, you can call or write them individually. Though, it's a bit of work, but you can try to get off mailing lists. And there's been talk of trying to establish some sort of a national, analog to the no call registry. But there are a few different ways that you can impact that. One, by trying to decrease the amount that comes to you via getting off the mailing list, and secondly, by applying pressure to some of the companies to start increasing the amount of recycled content they use, and it's starting to show some real success.
And the other question had to do with red-headed woodpeckers and evening grosbeaks.
Yeah, those are two birds that really have shown some serious declines. Red-headed woodpecker is included in my book, and it's decreased by over 60% over the last 30 or 40 years. Evening grosbeak is not actually included in my book, but it's declined by something like 70 or 80%. Different factors impacting those two birds. Red-headed woodpeckers are one of these species we're trying to learn more about, but they're a bird that occurs in often in sort of savanna habitats or areas that have sort of open park-like stands, mixes of grassland and a few oak trees and things like that. And we're seeing, of course, that kind of habitat has been rapidly lost in much of its breeding range in the sort of upper Midwest region, as well as probably just straight, loss of habitat in general and across its range. And then thirdly, from increased competition with introduced birds like starlings that also use nest cavities in trees to lay their eggs. So combination of those factors. And that's one, I think, continuing, always thinking about how to increase large blocks of habitat for any of these species is always kind of the first line of defense, the first thing you can do. I call it, how to protect the last of the large, and think about that in your area, in your community. That's the best thing, because that'll help buffer a lot of these species from a lot of other effects like invasive species and things like that. So evening grosbeak is a bird that tends to invade in winter from the boreal forest. And if you look at its range, unfortunately, it overlaps greatly with the area that's already been cut over in the southern part of the boreal forest of Canada, and that may well be the reason for this massive decline. Still just trying to understand it, but it's used to be 30 or 40 years ago, people would have flocks of 50 and 100 regularly in their backyards at their feeders. People would even complain about the amount of bird seed they went through, but that doesn't happen anymore.
No.
So.
Thank you, Annette. Appreciate your call. I want to get Gary from Milton on. Gary, hi to you.
Hello, great program.
This Thank
is
you.
A follow-up to the recent question on bird migration. Why is it that so many more species of birds, or at least land birds, migrate to the north during their breeding season and then go south into Central or South America, then the reverse, that is, going south to breed and coming back north? I know there's far more world land mass in the northern hemisphere. Could that be the reason, or are there perhaps other factors?
Well, I guess it's a combination of the fact that, one of the biggest factors is just that, in the winter, of course, so many of these birds are insect eaters, and they just wouldn't be able to survive. And even birds that eat, other sorts of food supplies in the winter, there's just not the food available for them. Interestingly, though, we are seeing in the southern U.S., it appears to be that there are more cases of birds starting to overwinter that normally would have gone even further south, potentially, very likely related to the climate change. You know, as things are warming, they're able to winter a little bit further north. So that's the main reason. There may be some interconnected things related to, the larger area and therefore more opportunities for less competition as compared to the highly competitive environment with the thousands of species that you're competing with sometimes in tropical areas.
Mm. Thank you for calling. Dave, quick comment from Augusta?
Yes, sir. I've got a question of the bluebird. We have put up numerous bluebird homes or houses on our farm, and we haven't seen one yet, and it's been a couple years. We do know that the sparrows try to get in there first and take over the little bluebird house, but I was wondering what other things we could do
to help that situation.
Yeah, bluebirds are one of the sort of success stories in conservation, in that by people just, increasing the numbers of artificial nesting cavities available to them, they've really been able to sort of sustain themselves in many areas. It's hard to say exactly what the issue could be for you. One of the things, again, I keep kind of jumping back to this, but oftentimes we forget that we have to think of our own area that we're trying to protect in the context of the landscape. And if your area might have great local habitat, but if it's surrounded by habitat that's not very good. Then it may be that's what is impacting it. So always thinking about trying to protect large landscapes is sort of the first.
And I want to break in here and just tell Dave that go to the Bluebird Association online and you'll find a lot more information on that. And Jeffrey, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And I'm enjoying your book, Birders Conservation Handbook, 100 North American Birds at Risk. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been fun.
Appreciate it very much. Jeffrey Wells, our guest. And thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.